Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to New Books in History, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and my usual role on the network is as the host for New Books in Genocide Studies. Occasionally, however, I pinch hit for other channels on the network, and that's what I'm doing today. And I'm really thrilled to be doing that today because I have a particular interest in memory and memorialization. So today's conversation with James Reston Jr. is really appropriate for me. Jim is a widely published author of books, plays, and articles, and he lectures throughout the country on a variety of subjects. And his new book is called A Rift in the Earth, Art, Memory, and the Fight for the Vietnam War Memorial. The book is a richly documented and elegantly written narrative of the political battles that surrounded the creation of the Vietnam's Veteran Memorial. I've read a number of books on this subject, and they're all good. But what makes Jim stand out is his eye for the telling detail or quote and his ability to provide capsule descriptions that make his creature characters come alive. But he also brings a very personal past to his writing, one that adds depth and meaning to the book. I'm thrilled to have a chance to talk about the book with him. So with that, Jim, welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us on New Books in History.
No, I'm delighted to be with you.
I mentioned in that little intro, this is a more personal book than others. So I'd like to start just by asking you to say a little bit about your own background during the Vietnam period and how that intersected with your decision to write this book now.
Well, I'm very much a creature of the Vietnam generation. I went through that struggle that the whole generation did about what to do personally about the Vietnam War, especially the men who were of draft age. And, virtually all of my college friends avoided service in one way or another. I faced that issue in 1965, where I had been kept out of the service for a couple of years, even though I was of prime draftable age and value. But in the summer of 1965, when Lyndon Johnson proclaimed that this is really war, I faced that moral decision about what to do. I was not a genuine conscientious objector. But I also didn't really want to continue to lead a kind of a fake deferment from the thing. So I decided to go into the military and was in for 3 years, 1965 to 68, which of course paralleled the buildup of the war itself. In the course of that service, which quite frankly, I was very pleased that I was not sent to Vietnam, but I was kept stateside through that whole thing. I became increasingly disenchanted with the war and very much against it in a way. And when I got out, I gravitated to the amnesty movement, which was a movement to argue that those who had gone into exile in Canada or Sweden should be brought back into the country with no deficit, no criminality, or even with an apology for having done something wrong. That's what the amnesty movement was all about. I probably wrote more about that issue than any other American writer, and it carried on into the mid 1970s. Behind that whole issue of amnesty was a much larger issue of reconciliation. And reconciliation, in this case, after divisive war. This was the most divisive war of the 20th century, and was really our equivalent of the Civil War for the 19th century. So, I was fascinated by that whole thing. It was deep in my sinews about the questions of service, particularly service after service in a flawed and possibly immoral enterprise, and then what happens to the nation when that conflict is over. So I turned that issue around in different ways, including the historical way of looking at what happened after the Civil War with the amnesties of Andrew Johnson and so forth, as a parallel to the subsequent pardons that Jimmy Carter did in 1976 and beyond. So what I'm saying is that reconciliation was a very important emotional question for me, and I think that by virtue of the fact that I had served in the military with an honorable discharge and all of that, and then went over to the other side as an advocate for those who had not served, it gave me, I think, the full scope of interest and emotional involvement with both the warrior and with the dissenter. So in 1985, I wrote a book called Sherman's March in Vietnam, in which I discussed the whole parallel between the post-U.S. Civil War and the post-Vietnam War, so far as reconciliation is concerned. And then I've done a lot of other things before and after that. But several years ago, like 3 years ago or so, I happened to be at Dartmouth College and talking to the advisor of my daughter, who was getting a master's at Dartmouth. And he happened to be an advisor already to Ken Burns in this Vietnam series that he was developing. And this professor said to me, this is going to be finest work that Ken Burns has done, or will do. It's going to top the Civil War. It will be his legacy. It's amazing what he's getting, and so forth. And I thought to myself, well, that's not going to be broadcast for a couple of years. Maybe I ought to go back to my old theme in all of this. There was a seed that had been planted, really two seeds even before that conversation at Dartmouth. One was that I was personally friendly with Frederick Hart, who became the sculptor of the three soldiers at the Vietnam Memorial. Very controversial, and we can get into that. But during the 1990s, when we were close in friendship, I talked at great length with him about the controversy over the memorial that he had been central to. The other thing was that I have one friend who's on the wall, with whom I trained in Army intelligence back in 1965. And we basically followed the same paths up to a point in our military careers, except that when I was ultimately deployed to a unit in Hawaii that he had been deployed to previously, to my great astonishment, he had left and he had gone to Vietnam. make a long story short, he was killed on the first day of the Tet Offensive in Hue City in Vietnam. And I was hugely upset about that. Partly, I suppose, because, you know, it could well have been me. We shared similar interests. We were on the same trajectory. I was lured by the romance, if that's the right word, of being an intelligence officer in Vietnam. And so, you know, what happened to him could clearly have happened to me. And that became a central aspect of Maya Lin's concept of her wall of black granite with the names of the dead, that those who survive go and see the friends that are on the wall, and perhaps it goes through their mind, as it has with me, that this could well have been me, not him. So those were the two emotional seeds of a rift in the earth, the friendship with Frederick Hard and the emotional connection to my friend on the wall.
So we'll get to the background and the debate in a moment, but because this is a podcast, we have listeners from all over the world, and many Americans know what the memorial looks like, but many people in other places do not. Can you maybe describe the memorial a little bit and where it sits in
Sure.
Washington and why that's important?
Yeah, I can do that, but I would really like to say this first. That it was very controversial in the proposal for a memorial about this lost war at all in the late 70s. And there is a great hero in that whole thing, a veteran by the name of Jan Scruggs, who had been badly wounded in Vietnam. And afterwards, he got into psychology in his academic work. And even though he was not a booster by any means of the Vietnam War itself, he had felt very deeply that those who, like himself, had served in Vietnam, and especially those who had died, their service needed to be acknowledged in some way or another. And so really through heroic effort on his part, he persuaded both Congress and the White House to have a competition for this memorial. Now the rules of the memorial were several important things. One was the memorial itself, as deeply divisive as Vietnam had been, was not to suggest pro or con about the value of the war itself. It couldn't be pro-war, it couldn't be anti-Vietnam War. It had to be neutral. And the second thing was that whatever it was had to list all 58,000 victims of the war itself. Those were the two central things. And what ensued was this extraordinary competition. That was the largest competition in the history of both American and European art, ultimately 1,421 submissions. Well, out of that, there was most astonishing result, which was that a 21-year-old Asian American woman who was an undergraduate at Yale University won the competition against some of the finest architects and artists in America. And she won with the simplest kind of a vision, which was simply two rather grand triangular slabs of black granite that would be joined, and that the memorial itself would be underground. It looks somewhat like a chevron, if you know what that is. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it simply was to have the names of the dead inscribed on this black granite with a walkway going down them. Well, the reason that she won, in my view, is not so much the simplicity of that that basic design, but the description that she made of the design, which was very moving about victims of war, and also really quite lovely and flowing in her description of this rift in the earth, as she described it. Well, this extraordinary result was put up in lights and had an immediate negative response from a group of very, very well connected veterans, very well connected with political connections in Congress and even in the White House, who argued that this was a disgraceful design, that it was black in color, and they argued that it was the color of shame. It was below ground, as if it was being hidden or it was something to be ashamed of. Some called it even like the black hole of Calcutta or an underground black prison. Some of the language was amazing. And it became very racist as a personal attack on this young Asian-American woman, Maya Lin. And so what ensued and what this book is about is this: not only the making of the memorial and the competition itself and the artistic issues of what an artist, or put it this way, what goes through an artist's mind about what would be appropriate to design artistically for a lost war. All of that fascinated me. So this group of well-connected veterans came after the design, did everything that they could to undermine it, and it became a Washington story that involved politicians in Congress and the White House about what should happen, whether this thing should be built at all. These veterans wanted to undermine it entirely and have a totally new competition in the whole thing, or if they couldn't succeed in that, because this had been a very professional competition and there had been a valid winner in the whole thing, then how could it be improved, as it were, or made acceptable to them? And that's how the notion of a figurative work of art, that is to say, a sculpture of soldiers from the Vietnam period, should be added to this disgraceful wall. So that debate went on for several years, basically. And what you ended up with is, I'm sorry, this is a long roundabout answer to your question, how we end up with this really quite amazing memorial in Washington that joins together a work of abstract art with a work of figurative art. And what eventuated was that Frederick Hart's sculpture of three soldiers, very beautifully done, very detailed, was in effect imposed upon the Maya Lin winning design, but much debate went on about where to put these these soldiers in relation to the wall, so that it didn't compete with the wall, but somehow complemented it. So that's what we have in Washington.
So that's a wonderful summary of the kind of theme of the book. So let's go back and unpack a little of that. You said there's a competition. So why did they decide to do it as a competition, and who was the jury?
Well, you know, the place designated for this memorial was something called Constitution Gardens in Washington, which is basically hallowed ground.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was park space that was contiguous or is contiguous to Lincoln Memorial. There was another memorial already underway to the founders of the American Revolution. And, you know, there in the distance was the Washington Monument and so on. So there was even a debate whether there should be a Vietnam War memorial put in this rather lovely sloping ground. And so when Jimmy Carter authorized that there should be such a memorial, and Congress put a bill in, and that this was to happen, at least the poobahs in the artistic world said, well, this is so important that it really must be an open competition, so that virtually anyone could put in a submission to the thing, and whoever was going to win would be hallowed forever, because this is just an amazing opportunity for any artist to get their work there. So pushed by art critics and the art establishment, this competition was established, and that it was very appropriate that it be done at the highest level. There were 8 judges for the thing that came from the best schools of art and architecture in America, Harvard and MIT, and 2 very, very well-regarded sculptors that had their work in the finest museums of art museums of America were on the jury, and several architects that built some of our most notable buildings in America. So it was a really a blue ribbon jury.
And so part of the dispute later on will be about the abstract nature of Myelin's exhibit. Was there any expectation or stated preference in the rules or in the attitudes of the jury before they saw the entries as to what kind of memorial they were looking for?
No, I don't know of any preconception along those lines. I mean, it ended up being this amazing scene where each submitter could have 2 boards that were something like, I would say about 4 feet by 3 feet. And on those boards would be a visual representation of the vision of the artist, and also a handwritten description of what the concept was going to be. With 1,421 such submissions, they had to have a hangar at Andrews Air Force Base to hang all the submissions there. And these 8 men went through the thing to winnow it down to something like 30 or 40 at first, and then down to 15, and finally down to 3 or 4, something along those lines. But I think there was no preconception at all. If you look at all the 1,421, which of course I have, they're all at the Library of Congress, where I did most of my work on this book. you know, they run the gamut of figurative art to very interesting landscape designing and some really kooky things. And it was just a tremendous diffusion of creative thinking about the whole thing. As it happens, the straightforward figurative artists were a pretty small number. And the much larger number of the whole thing was really a focus on landscape artistry, where, you know, you were going to have 2 acres or something like this of this valid ground, and how it could be imagined that tourists would come from everywhere to ponder the Vietnam War, and it would be a park-like experience of walking through a beautifully landscaped memorial. So most of the submissions were like that. There was, as I said, a handful of figurative sculptures, some that were just simply figurative. Frederick Hart, who I talked about before, a sculpture of the eventual 3 soldiers at the thing, was part of a group, but he had sculptures in his vision of the thing, but he teamed up with a landscape architect that really kind of dominated this mission. So, you know, it was an array. The scope of the thing was really quite remarkable.
Huh. So you point out in your book that the jury, and particularly the chair, and I'm sorry, I think I'm pronouncing it right, Paul Spreiregen, is that right? Or maybe Spreiregen,
yeah.
I'm sorry. That they wonder if there's going to be, after they've selected this memorial, they wonder how the public will receive it, and they're afraid that it might not be received well. So what is it that they're concerned about, and how do they try and prepare for this?
Well, I think they probably intuitively understood instantaneously that if this was just black granite with names on it, that people would object to that it was going to be underground, that there was no American flag to be put on it, there was no inscription about the glories of service and gallantry and heroism and all of those things that we often find on war memorials, so that it would be flat. It was not laudatory in any way about those who had gone to Vietnam. So I think they understood that. They also, I'm sure, were probably pretty shocked when they tore the tape off the number and found out that the author of this concept was a 21-year-old Asian American woman, recognized that there would be public relations problems with that, and so they did their best to launch the thing in as glitzy a way as possible. And instantaneously, a very well-established architect here in Washington was donned as the architect of record, because Mylin didn't know anything about how the practicalities of realizing this memorial. So there were a host of practical problems about executing this design below ground, you know, flooding and all of that. So they pulled out all the stops, and I think hoped that this would be seen as really quite a wonderful remarkable work of genius by this young woman. But, I think they probably knew things were about to hit the fan.
So you say, Bob, you remind us, Myelin is young, 21. How does she get along with I'm not even sure what word to use, her patrons, her sponsors, her contractual partners, her the people with the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Funds and the architects with whom she's going to work?
Well, I mean, one cannot read this book without coming away with a tremendous admiration for the strength of this 21-year-old girl. I mean, she was facing, the powers that she was facing, the political powers, the veteran powers, the likes of Ross Perot. There's no doubt in my mind that President Reagan weighed in on this kind of thing eventually, that she had detractors in the Congress who were berating her and her design. Not infrequently, it had a racial tinge to it. And, she just knew what she wanted, and she just stood up and fought against them all. That said, she was extremely difficult to work with. And I came away from writing this book being very admiring of that as well. That when somebody said, well, you insist on this being very thin granite, and if we do very thin granite, it will crack and it will disintegrate in some way or another. She was having none of it. It was not to be thicker, because she had this metaphor in her mind of taking a knife and cutting this rift in the earth, and that's the way it was, I got going to be. Had to fight about an American flag. These veterans thought it was disgraceful that there was not an American flag there. So indeed, there was a bill put into Congress that would legislate that there had to be a 40-foot American flag at the apex of the wall. No, nothing doing, she said, and the artistic world supported her, that would completely undermine the artistic notion of this horizontal creation by having a vertical piece go right at the apex of the wall. It was absurd. And when this compromise notion that was a kind of sop to the veterans who hated it, to impose a figurative statue on her work, she fought it tooth and nail. The argument was she had won this competition with this vision, and that it was a professional competition she wanted, and to impose a statue upon her artistic work was like painting a mustache on the Mona Lisa. It was an atrocity artistically. Well, ultimately, her design possibly was not going to be built at all if she didn't compromise. And that's where it became a Washington story of what the compromise should be, if it was to be this figurative work of art imposed upon, what would it look like? And once we saw what it would look like, if it wasn't too outrageous, where would it be put in relation to her wall so it didn't undermine the whole thing? These were very interesting artistic judgments, and they were fought out somewhat in Congress and also in a little agency called the Commission of Fine Arts here in Washington that had the ultimate power to agree or not agree to something. All of that said, the sculptor Frederick Hart was very helpful in the end with what he created, because while he was being pushed by these veterans to do some sort of heroic statue about, you know, charging up a hill heroically against the enemy in some fashion or another, I mean, the sculptures of places like Fort Benning and Fort Jackson were invoked as the kind of thing that was needed for this wall. So, no, nothing doing, said he. That would be totally inappropriate, not only for the war, perhaps, but also in relation to the wall. I mean, you couldn't possibly have a sculpture that had a soldier saying, "Follow me," looking at a wall that had 58,000 dead on it. It would be outrageous and ridiculous. And so what ultimately he was going for in the crafting of his three soldiers was an accent on their youth and their camaraderie and their sense of awe and a certain confusion in their faces and so on. And so it's left to the viewer of this extraordinary place in Washington to decide for themselves as to whether these two works of art really work together. But many years later, here we are, whatever it is, 35 years later, these artistic questions seem to be rather esoteric, because this is the memorial that we've got, and it's the most successful memorial in Washington by far. And it's become a kind of spiritual place in Washington that is absolutely unique.
So, yeah, I want to get to that just a second. So maybe the way to get to that for me is, could you say a little bit more about the opponents? And I'll just give you a few names. You don't have to mention them all, but people like Tom Carhart or James Webb, or you mentioned Ross Perot, and you mentioned some of the things they disliked about it. How did they try and press their case? What were their tactics? And did they share a kind of common vision for what the space should be, if not for Meyerland's proposal?
Well, there are really only two important people of the detractors. One was Jim Webb, who at the time was in a congressional committee of some note for veterans, but he was and is a very powerful personality. He is an ex-Marine who was in the thick of combat in Vietnam. And then when he came out of Vietnam, he came home and he wrote a very successful novel about his experience. So he was really quite an estimable detractor. Once he went public with his qualms about the design, he started to write op-ed pieces in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post. And he started to lobby in Congress because he was already well-connected and started to lobby against this. And indeed got some pretty strong-willed congressmen behind his position in the whole thing. So, as we all know, he went on to become senator from Virginia and ultimately a presidential candidate in 2016, briefly. thank goodness, as a presidential candidate, but very powerful personality. And so the other was Ross Perot, who had a roommate in college who I think ultimately died in Vietnam. But Ross Perot is this loquacious, fast-talking, immensely successful Texas businessman who also ran for president much more successfully than Jim Webb did. And he was a very important national figure at the time. Interestingly, he was also a contributor to the original group that Jan Scruggs' group that I mentioned, Scruggs, who were trying to raise the money for this memorial. Ultimately, they had to raise something like $7 million. And Ross Perot was an early contributor to this thing. When he saw the winning design, he was totally horrified at what he had contributed to and immediately became a detractor of the thing, cast aspersions on the group that had, Jan Scruggs' group that had been behind this whole thing, started to demand his money back and on and on. And there ensued in this war, I have referred to this as the Second Vietnam War, there would be a rather regular national television feature in places like CBS and NBC, where A Mile In and Ross Perot and Jan Scruggs would be a threesome on national television, you know, shouting at one another about their various positions in this whole thing. So it became a national controversy, and as I said, the memorial per se was very, very much in jeopardy. And it only ultimately happened by virtue of his compromise to add a statue.
So you mentioned, I think, quite appropriately, the fact that the memorial has now become not just accepted, but widely admired, wildly admired even. And so I'm wondering where you think American memory of Vietnam is now, and what role the memorial played in that?
Yes, well, for starters, this memorial has changed the way in which wars will be remembered forever. It came into the debate about the other memorials to various American wars that are in Washington, and a large preponderance of them are, you know, prominent men on horseback. And this memorial has changed that. I think it will be very hard in the future to do anything like what most of the memorials to war are like in Washington. I went to Vietnam when I was at the end stage of writing this book, and was taken to a memorial, a hallowed ground in Vietnam for the dead of the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. It is a very lovely site just north of the demilitarized zone, as it used to be known. And it has pagodas, and it has individual graves for the soldiers who died in the conflict. But interestingly to me, within each of these pagodas that are salted around this this cemetery was slabs of black granite with the names of the North Vietnamese dead. So, in effect, Mylin's concept and the Vietnam Memorial had an influence on our old enemies in the way in which they would choose to memorialize their dead. The extraordinary thing to me about this memorial is its transformation in the last 30 years. It began as a veterans memorial. It's no longer a veterans memorial. It's become widened to the whole Vietnam generation, those who fought, but also those who resisted. And I have argued very passionately that the memorial, as it now stands, is as much a comfortable place for those who resisted the war as for those who fought in it. That as a resistor in the streets, you know, protesting with great vociferousness the wrongness of the Vietnam War, when they go to that memorial today, they can feel good that they look at the terrible carnage of that war and know that they had a part personally in trying to stop it. So it's transformed in that way, I think, widened in that way to the whole Vietnam generation that faced this terrible choice about what to do. Beyond that, as the decades have gone on, I think it's superseded the Vietnam War itself and become a memorial to all wars and to the cost of war. This was central to Mylin's concept from the beginning, that's what one was meant to ponder as you looked at this physical space, that it was about the cost of war. And in the writings, including my own in the last couple of years, I mean, it's been pointed out that in the transition from the Johnson administration to the Nixon administration, when there was, now it's proven, a real opportunity to end the Vietnam War in 1968, that was a moment at which there were 19,000 dead in the Vietnam War, and we end up with 58,000 of the thing. So it's now a memorial prodded by this divisive war to all wars, and it's become this place of contemplation, this place of spiritual contemplation. And, you know, people from all over the world want to see it. They don't remember anything about Pleiku or maybe even My Lai or any of the other great battles, the Tet Offensive. I just don't think that the preponderance of people who go to the Vietnam Memorial nowadays, that their mind rests on the details of the Vietnam War itself. It's transcended that and become this really quite remarkable spiritual space in Washington.
So, and I tell my students this, sometime 10 years from now, 15, 20, it's not really clear to me, we're going to have a discussion about a memorial or a monument or something about Iraq and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. What can the debate and the process by which Mylin's memorial was chosen and constructed, how can that help us think about how to memorialize the wars we're in now?
Well, I think it will be much different. I mean, it's I think part of the disgrace of the Vietnam history that Richard Nixon worked very hard to de-emotionalize, if there is such a word, Vietnam war that he was pursuing by ending the draft and establishing a volunteer army. The 58,000 dead came in a period when every young man of draftable age was required to go into the military, and if they went into the military and they were ordered to Vietnam, they had to go. By the establishment of a volunteer army, there's all this claptrap now about our professional army. We have the most professional army in the world. And it's made up of people who have voluntarily gone into the military. There is all this glitzy advertising that is meant to lure young men into volunteering by all the excitement and adventure and all the fabulous technology that they're going to get to use and so forth. And so it's moved into this PR thing. At the same time, and I guess this is a good thing, victims of Iraq and Afghanistan are, by comparison to Vietnam, quite small.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about a couple of thousand deaths in both of those wars, and in the endless Afghanistan war, we're talking about American soldiers just advising and never actually being in harm's way and so forth, even though I guess Trump is changing that. but at any rate, if we can imagine the end of Afghanistan, I guess the Iraq thing is over, but the Middle East is in total chaos. What would artists think if given the challenge to memorialize those wars? It certainly wouldn't focus on the enormity of the dead. It might, something that focused on bravery and technology might be the way that we would want to go. The politicians have managed to detoothe the thing to the extent that the American people are disconnected from from the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq, in a way that when you had the draft with Vietnam, they were not disconnected. So maybe something that focuses on patriotism and valor and technology and special forces and cyber warfare and all of that, all of the bells and whistles that we're now getting, maybe that's what artists would think they ought to do and what politicians would think we ought to have. So yeah, I think it'd be very different.
Huh. Well, you've been very generous with your time, Jim, and I really appreciate it. And as I've said at the beginning, it's a wonderful book. I learned a lot from it, and highly recommend it to the listeners. I always end podcasts in the same way, by asking guests to suggest a book or two, maybe a movie, something else. Something that was important to you while you were working on this book or thinking about this book. Maybe framing that as, what should my listeners read this weekend? So what would you suggest?
Well, I think that the Ken Burns documentary series is probably the best documentary series that's ever been made and ever will be made.
Wow.
I seriously doubt that any other war in the future can be as graphically captured as he was able to do over a 10-year period. It's absolutely going to be head and shoulders above anything we'll ever get again. So I was, you know, I was very eager to become part of the launch of his series for a literary reason. And that is that I have found in other work that sometimes when there's a great event that happens and the author chooses to attack it from a deflective angle, from a side angle, some very interesting insights can emerge. And so, you know, what I set out to do, knowing that Perns' thing was coming and knowing that I would be published at the same time, that I was going at the memorialization question, the memory question, would be quite different, though complementary, to seeing this awful war be so graphically displayed, and both sides of that war being so intimately chronicled. That was just totally amazing. Yes, he touches on the memorial at the end of the thing, but that's not what's going to be remembered about that series. So, you know, I'm very glad to be out there, which, you know, quite all by myself with this kind of treatment.
Well, I have all 15 hours of it on DVR, and that might make for a long weekend, but I'm looking forward to see it, and I've as with you, I've heard lots of praise for that series. So I want to thank you again, Jim. The book, as we said, is A Rift in the Earth, and this is James Rustin Jr., and thank you so much, Jim, for being with us.
Thank you, Kelly.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with James Rustin Jr. about his new book, A Rift in the Earth, Art, Memory, and the Fight for the Vietnam War Memorial, published by Arcadia. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or Stitcher or other podcast providers or from the webpage for the New Books Network of Podcasts. Thanks for the download and have a great month.